This is the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Anna Sale, sitting in for Brian today. Brian's out observing Rosh Hashanah with his family. But our presidential election series, 30 Issues in 30 Days, continues. This is where we let others focus only on the horse race. We dig into an issue a day for 30 shows between now and the election. You can see our issues gallery at wnyc.org/issues. Today, we're focusing on an area where President Barack Obama and Governor Mitt Romney share a lot of common ground. We're talking about K through 12 education and the plan for educating for the future. We'll discuss where Obama and Romney agree, where they diverge, with Michelle McNeil, assistant editor and federal policy reporter at Education Week. But first, as you listen, a reminder that 30 Issues in 30 Days is not just on the radio. It's a full-service multimedia series. We have a collaboration with longform.org featuring great articles where you can dig in more to these issues. We are also working with the WNYC Data News team. They are producing great visualizations and graphics to illuminate the context for these issues. Today's graphic is really interesting. If you go to wnyc.org/issues and click on 30 Issues Educating for Tomorrow K through 12, you can see this illustration of how charter schools have expanded across the country over the last 12 years, how they expanded, where they expanded. That's at wnyc.org/issues. But to start, let's start there with charter schools and where President Obama and Governor Romney agree. Here's President Obama articulating his vision for improving schools when he was running for president 4 years ago. Here's what he had to say then.
I believe in public schools, but I also believe in fostering competition within the public schools. And that's why, as president, I'll double the funding for responsible charter schools.
That was September 2008. Here's Governor Mitt Romney talking to the NAACP convention last July.
Charter schools are so successful that almost every politician can find something good to say about them. But as we saw in Massachusetts, true reform requires much more than talk. As governor, I vetoed the bill blocking charter schools. But my legislature was 87% Democrat, and my veto could have easily been overridden. So I joined with the Black Legislative Caucus, and their votes helped preserve my veto, which meant that new charter schools, including some in urban neighborhoods, would be opened.
Again, that's Governor Romney speaking to the NAACP convention in July. Michelle McNeil with Education Week. Is it true what Governor Romney said at the top there, that charter schools are so successful that almost every politician has something good to say about them?
I think Governor Romney, I think it's pretty much true. Charter schools are something that have been embraced by both Republicans and Democrats, especially in your large urban centers where you have Democratic mayors. They have been very much embracing charter schools as another option for kids and for parents who may otherwise be going to struggling schools. And Republicans have certainly embraced charter schools as part of a big menu of options that they really want to see all kids have. And as we heard in your opening segment, charter schools have been championed by President Obama himself. So, yeah, I think that there are really good charter schools out there who have a lot of supporters. That is not to say that there are not some poorly performing charter schools out there as well. So, you know, they're not all a good thing, but generally I think they're pretty well received.
So how has President Obama over the last 4 years sought to expand charter schools? He said there that he would double the funding for responsible charter schools. Did he do that?
So he has increased funding for charter schools. Perhaps more importantly, he made charter schools a prominent feature of his Race to the Top competition. That competition was something he designed as part of the economic stimulus package, where he dangled $4 billion out in front of states to devise their own education improvement plans. And to really get that money, states had to really encourage the expansion of charter schools. So President Obama tried to use money from the stimulus package as part of this competition in which he encouraged states to really expand the growth of high-quality charter schools. So within the tools, he can only do so much. States are, you know, states and locals still really control schools, but Obama has really walked the walk when it comes to charter schools.
So again, the way Race to the Top worked is it to compete for this carrot of extra federal money, states had to change laws to be eligible to enter into the contest. So what ended up happening? How much did it sort of accelerate changes in state laws?
So in the run-up to the competition, we saw the majority of states really wanted a piece of this money. If you remember, I mean, we were in really rough economic times, and states were desperate for money. So they, you know, they went to great lengths to try to win this money. And so we saw several, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but we saw several states change their laws to either lift caps. A lot of states had caps on the number of charter schools that could be in a state. A lot of states lifted those caps. And a lot of states that did not previously have laws creating charter schools did, in fact, change their laws to encourage charter schools. And, you know, these laws are still on the books. So even in states that did not win the money, only 12 states won Race to the Top money. So in the dozen or so states that did not win, we still are left with these new laws on the books to encourage charter schools. So there has been some lasting impression from this law.
So given that record, I was surprised in reading into this. You go to whitehouse.gov, you read about President Obama's education positions and how he talks about it rhetorically, and there's no mention of charter schools. And there wasn't a lot of talk about charter schools at the Democratic Convention in Charlotte. Do you see the Obama campaign this time around de-emphasizing charter schools?
So that's a really important observation. We also here at Education Week took note of what he did and did not talk about, like during the convention speeches. And charter schools have not always been embraced by teachers' unions. And teachers' unions are a very important part of the Democratic base. And so it's true, you did not see a lot of talk about charter schools. You also did not hear a lot of talk about performance pay for teachers, which is another thing that Obama has really pushed for that is not always popular with unions that he did not talk about at the convention. So, I mean, I think you are definitely seeing it's an election season and he is picking and choosing what he talks about when he's out on the campaign trail and when he's trying to rally support from his base, of which unions are such a critical part.
It is a day when teachers are not in the classroom here in New York City. If you're listening, teachers, and have something to say about this conversation, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. What do you think about the different candidates' positions? Do you notice who's president in your classroom? Does it trickle down to how you engage with your students, or is it just basically a political debate that happens in Washington? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. So let's shift to Governor Mitt Romney and his education policy. So there's agreement, overlap, as far as whether charter schools are a good thing. Where does he diverge in terms of his policies with President Obama?
Sure. I think that there are three big places where the two candidates really diverge. One of them is related to charters, and that's school choice. President Obama and a lot of Democrats embrace charter schools, which are public schools, as a viable choice. Republicans want to go much farther, and Governor Romney wants to allow kids and their parents to be able to use federal dollars and take those dollars to any school of their choice, including private schools. This private school choice is something that Republicans have traditionally supported and Democrats have traditionally not. That is one big area. The second is spending. Democrats and President Obama want to, at a minimum, protect spending on education and go even farther and invest more money in early education, in K-12, even in making college affordable. Republicans, Governor Romney and his running mate, Paul Ryan, they want to rein in spending. They haven't been very specific about how that would affect K-12, but there's a clear difference there. The third and final area where I think there's a big difference is just the federal role in education. President Obama and his education secretary, Arne Duncan, have advocated a very aggressive role of federal government in keeping states in check when it comes to making sure that they're holding, you know, their schools accountable. Republicans, I think, favor a more scaled-back role, sending more of that, putting more of that responsibility back on the states. So those are, I think, the three main areas where you see some divergence.
So I want to go back to that idea of school choice that Governor Romney is championing. So he's talked about these directing federal dollars to parents as opposed to districts and states. This is Title I money. This is money for kind of low-income students. This is also special education money. How would this work? Would parents receive a check from the federal government that then they could use to pay private school tuition? What's the proposal here specifically?
That's a very good question. The proposal is very scant on details, so we don't exactly know the mechanism by which that would work. So those are good questions. And ones, you know, Governor Romney is apparently going to start laying out more specifically in the coming days his domestic policy priorities and more specifics about his plans. So we are eagerly awaiting some more details on that. I will say that the federal government really only pays about 10% of K-12 education. The rest of it is paid for by states and local taxpayers. So even if parents did, say, get a check in the mail, it would likely be a pretty small check that wouldn't pay for, say, expensive tuition at a private school. So that's important to keep in mind as well.
We're going to take a call from Clara in the Bronx. She's a teacher. Clara, what do you think about President Obama and Governor Romney's positions on K-12 education?
Thank you. Good morning. I am very disgusted with the both of them for pushing charter schools, and it isn't just because I'm a teacher. My own students, they have asked about charter schools, and some of them, in some instances, have applied, and they feel like because they're sort of on the lower rung of the economic ladder, that they either have to get into a charter school by a lottery, whereas a public school, they can just walk right in their neighborhood and register and get an education. The charter schools are the death knell of the public schools, and it's more on this line of privatizing something that works very well and helps people move on to college. It's also very discriminatory in that what I see is children on the lower economic ladder, if their parents can't pay to prep them for a charter school or test for private schools, that if there isn't a public school there, which from what I see a lot in Manhattan, most of the closed public schools just get turned over into real estate and get pumped up for big high rises. And it's basically real estate or other private organizations taking over what formerly used to be a place of education and learning and betterment.
Well, Claire, I want to ask you, President Obama and Governor Romney both point to charter schools as a mechanism to sort of encourage innovation and entrepreneurial sort of change in educating kids, that it's useful competition to force traditional public schools to improve. Have you seen any of those dynamics of charter schools have expanded in New York City? Has it affected your classroom?
Not in the years since they've promoted it, and that's really a lot of hot air because charter is just a metaphor or another word for privatization. And it's really disgraceful because there's a huge move, and this is reflected in the Chicago standoff between the mayor and the teachers, where they see the same thing too. And I believe earlier this morning your news said something, quoted a teacher about the elephant in the room, and that is the elephant in the room. It's any means necessary to push aside, get rid of public, anything public. And I thought it was very interesting this morning because NPR is National Public Radio, and I'm not asking you guys to take a position, but the word public seems to be something that's turned into something horrible or something that means something bad, and or it's a doublespeak for poor people of society. And all I see in that respect for my students is discrimination because they're mostly the children that occupy the seats in public schools. And they're basically being told, well, your school isn't good enough and doesn't deserve because we're going to get rid of your teachers. And so you're going to have to figure out a way or somehow or find some money to go somewhere else, because charter schools do cost money.
All right, Claire, we're going to leave it there. We've got John, a teacher in Queens. You've got a different take?
No, I don't think I have a different take. You know, I was just actually this morning looking at the most extensive study of charter schools, which is at Stanford University, and it shows that 37% are less than public schools, something like 17%. It's different in state to state, but I agree with this woman that charter schools is just a backdoor attempt to privatize the public school system, that the billions of dollars that are at stake, that there are powerful interests that want to get their hands on them and to use that money to start profit schools. Teachers in the public schools are expected to solve all the problems of a neighborhood that come through their doors, in our case, 6 hours and 50 minutes a day. We just don't have those resources. Teachers today facing problems that teachers in the past never, ever had to face. It's a much different society with much different rules and much different expectations with much different skills needed. And we're just being the whipping boys and girls of the entire education system.
Well, thanks so much for your call. I want to ask you, Michelle McNeil from Education Week, we're having this conversation as teachers in Chicago are starting their second week out on the picket line. Does it feel like the dynamics in terms of the kind of political conversation in 2012 are different from 2008 when you have Rahm Emanuel as mayor of Chicago, former chief of staff for President Obama? Is President Obama kind of approaching this question of teachers unions differently than he did 4 years ago?
I think Democrats in general, and including President Obama, and you heard him talk about this perhaps a little bit on the campaign trail back in 2008, but they are definitely embracing policies that are often in conflict with unions, with an important part of their base. President Obama thinks that teachers should be evaluated in part on student performance, and this is something that's at the center of what Chicago teachers are striking about. So Democrats are becoming more willing, I think, to take on an important part of their political base. And they're walking a fine line. They're trying to, acknowledge the hard work and the challenging situations that the callers were talking about, while also trying to push the profession forward and to think about doing things differently. So, yeah, I think it is different than 4 years ago.
Mike, in Jersey City, you started a charter school?
Yeah, I was one of the co-founders of one of the first charter schools in the state of New Jersey. Okay, and I've got to tell you, I have to take issue with much of what's going on here. Since it's the standard teachers union rap, where rather than criticize charter schools on the facts, they just make up their own facts. Charter schools are public schools. Okay, they do not discriminate. That reference to a lottery is a mechanism designed to prevent discrimination. All right? The data in New Jersey, at least, shows that they are most popular in neighborhoods with below-average socioeconomic situations, precisely because they offer parents an affordable way of pursuing a better public education for their kids. Okay? Now, there's a criticism of charter schools that's also imaginary, which is the assumption that all charter schools are going to be better than public schools, which has never been assumed. The assumption is that the competition among schools and the ability of parents to vote with their feet, which is something that public school teachers consistently deny to poor families, okay, is going to drive all schools to be better. I can tell you in my community, that has certainly been the case. It is significant, I would note, that in Chicago, where this strike is going on, the majority of the teachers in the Chicago public school system send their kids to private schools. They don't send their kids to the schools that they teach in and that they're carrying on about how this is, performance standards and so on and so forth are really inappropriate, and that somehow this is all discriminating against poor children. Even though they seem to be wanting to perpetuate the status quo, that they wouldn't be willing to send their own kids to.
All right. Thanks, Mike, in Jersey City. I want to ask you, Michelle McNeil, you mentioned school funding and education funding as an issue, and noted that about 10% of funding for schools come from the federal government, just about 10%. But let's remind listeners about the Obama administration record on school funding. How much of the funding was a reaction to the economic downturn and trying to contain the damage in terms of state budget deficits, and how much were they able to prioritize funding for some of these education initiatives?
So the Obama administration, in response to the Great Recession, as part of the economic stimulus package that passed Congress in 2009, did manage to get $100 billion for education. That included some higher education, and that is where that's where the race to the top competition was born out of that money. And then, so that was a huge, unprecedented federal infusion of money into K-12. And then, you know, since then, you know, the administration has passed some smaller, the administration was able to achieve some smaller victories, such as for an education jobs fund, which helped continue to protect and save teacher jobs. It's money that went to the states to help prop up state education budgets. And then, the administration has also worked to keep the federal Department of Education's budget pretty healthy, even in these lean times, to protect programs like the Title I program you were talking about earlier for disadvantaged kids. So the administration certainly has tried to pump a lot of money into K-12.
So as far as what Governor Romney would do if he became President Romney, as far as education spending, we can look to the Paul Ryan budget, which had a 20% cut in domestic discretionary spending, which includes education. But Governor Romney's campaign has pointed out that the Paul Ryan budget is not necessarily the Romney plan. What do we know about how he dealt with education funding in Massachusetts? Are there any ways we can project forward and what he might do in Washington from that record?
So if you look back at his record in Massachusetts, and of course being governor of Massachusetts, very different than being president. But yes, if you look back to his record there for signs, what he did was he clearly recognized that education was important. He was a pretty big proponent of things like high standards, of trying to make college affordable for low-income kids. When he came into the governorship there, he inherited a budget deficit, and he put forth a budget recommendation that attempted to keep funding flat. And I think I'd have to go back and refresh my memory on Massachusetts state budget history, but there were some negotiations back and forth, and I think there ended up being a cut. But I think what was important was he originally wanted to protect education. So I think that it's really unclear what he would do as president and how that would affect K-12 spending. But I think if you look back, he clearly values education. He made different initiatives a priority in Massachusetts. So I think there will be some tension there.
And you made a really interesting observation in an Education Week article that in some ways the education debate and Romney's position on education reform is akin to the position he's found himself in when it comes to health care and the overhaul with the Affordable Care Act, that Governor Romney has supported initiatives that now President Obama is supporting at the national level as he faces sort of concern about spending in the Republican Party. So he's having to sort of figure out how to walk this line of having this record of having very similar positions to President Obama, but having to make distinctions.
You know, that's exactly right. And, you know, both candidates, Obama and Romney, are having to walk the line between being supportive of policies they believe in and also needing to get elected. And, you know, Governor Romney, is certainly, I think there'll be a lot of questions that may be answered in the coming days as Governor Romney seeks to outline more details of his plan. So I think it's going to be important to see what he says here in the coming days, especially about K-12.
All right, it's 30 Issues in 30 Days. Today we're talking about K-12 education with Michelle McNeil, assistant editor and federal policy reporter at Education Week. We will follow what the Romney campaign says in the coming days about K-12 education. You can see the whole 30 Issues in 30 Days series at wnyc.org/issues. Michelle McNeil, thank you so much for joining WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up, we'll talk about not K-12 education, but pre-K, and whether it should be universal. It's the Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Anna Sale, in for Brian Lehrer today. We've been talking about K through 12 education, but what about pre-K education? It's not something we're hearing about much on the campaign trail, but economists and scientists are increasingly interested in the benefits of getting kids in school earlier. Did you know that only 58% of 3 to 5 year old Americans are enrolled in any kind of early education? And it's even lower for low-income kids, just over 50%. So right now we're going to talk about pre-K, where the candidates stand, and what the value of it is in the first place. Dana Goldstein joins us now. She's a Brooklyn-based journalist and a fellow at the New America Foundation and the Nation Institute. She wrote about pre-K recently in a piece for Good Magazine. Welcome to WNYC, Dana.
Thanks, Anna.
So I was surprised by that figure, 58% of kids getting pre-K education in America. What are the basic arguments for getting kids into school before they turn 5 years old?
The most basic argument is that a lot of the achievement gap that develops between poor children and their middle class or affluent peers is actually visible on the very first day of kindergarten. So, for example, we know that a typical poor child comes to school knowing only two letters of the alphabet that they can identify visually and say, whereas a middle class kid will know all 26 on that first day. So that really argues for the fact that we need to be working on these pre-literacy skills as well as social and emotional development for all children beginning at a younger age.
So how would it work? I mean, we're still talking about, I mean, kindergarten is not mandatory in American schools. It depends on state and local rules. How would universal pre-K work?
Well, some states like New Jersey and Massachusetts have instituted universal pre-K. Actually, it's interesting, Mitt Romney vetoed a law for universal pre-K while he was governor of Massachusetts. But in the years since, that state has embraced universal pre-K. And now 70% of Massachusetts three and four-year-olds are enrolled in school. So there is progress possible at the state level. And President Obama has done some work at the federal level, too, that we can talk about.
Well, let's talk about that, because when I think of pre-K in terms of federal policy, I think of the Head Start program, which started during the War on Poverty in 1965, trying to target low-income kids. But it's been criticized for not being effective. And President Obama, during his years in office, he tried to figure out ways to make Head Start work better. Here he is describing that.
Now, under the old rules governing Head Start, there just wasn't enough accountability. If a program wasn't providing kids with quality services, there was no incentive to improve. Under the new rule, programs are going to be regularly evaluated against a set of clear, high standards. If a program meets these standards, and we believe the majority of Head Start programs will, then their grants will be renewed. But if a program isn't giving children the support they need to be ready for school, if classrooms are unsafe, if finances aren't in order, if kids aren't learning what they need to learn, then other organizations will be able to compete for that grant. We're not just going to put money into programs that don't work. We will take money and put them into programs that do.
So what have been the criticisms of Head Start? What are the programs that have not been working well?
So Head Start serves 1 million children, but across 50,000 schools and centers. So it's an incredibly broad program, and the quality has been uneven. So research has shown that by fifth grade, a lot of the benefits of Head Start seem to fade out academically. They can't be seen in test scores. Of course, that's not to say that there aren't other social, emotional benefits of attending a Head Start center that aren't easily measured. But what Obama did with this process that's called the recompetition process is he forced those 50,000 centers to compete if they got a low quality rating. And that is actually a really big story here in New York City, because the Administration for Children's Services, which is New York City's Head Start provider, it serves 18,000 kids, it is being forced to recompete. So here in New York, we're going to see how this all plays out. It's still underway.
How do you evaluate whether a Head Start program is working or not? These four-year-olds are not taking standardized tests, I imagine.
Well, that's a really great question. And actually, one of the things the Obama administration is interested in states and cities and schools doing is something called kindergarten readiness assessment. And they're asking schools to take a look at how they might do this. And this is when a child arrives at kindergarten, there'll be some sort of assessment in the first weeks or months at what they do know, and then they can connect those scores back to the Head Start or the pre-K program that they attended. So there is some talk of standardized assessment of 4- and 5-year-olds, which, as you can imagine, is quite controversial. There's different ways of doing this.
So as far as a Head Start program that's working poorly, it's when you look at a fifth grader and you don't see any kind of advantage from them having been enrolled in Head Start.
I mean, I think it's probably a lot more accurate to look at a kindergartner or first grader, because the more years you are past the Head Start experience itself, it just becomes more and more difficult to pull apart the threads of, well, they have a family that's involved with their education, they've had 4 teachers since then and all that. So there's a lot of ways to look at it. You know, they are also visiting the Head Start centers and actually taking a look at what the classrooms look like, whether they're clean and well-organized, whether the teachers seem well-trained in how to interact with 3- and 4-year-olds. There's very purposeful sort of vocabulary and ways of interacting with children that age to build their cognitive and social skills. And there's a lot of good research on how to do that. And some Head Start centers and some preschools have embraced that sort of best practices, and some have not.
So walk me through a model pre-K program. How does it work? And then what do we think are the advantages of getting a kid into school in 3- and 4-year-olds? What do you see are the results?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that in a lot of informal child care centers that a lot of 3- and 4-year-old American kids are in, there could be a TV playing in the background all day. So it's not necessarily that if you're in an organized setting that there's an educational sort of sense of what's going on there. So I think in an ideal pre-K classroom, you're going to have a teacher that's working with children individually in groups on a bunch of things. First would be pre-literacy, identifying letters, looking at words, identifying numbers as well. Numeracy is really important. And then also the life skills sort of things that are really important, from zipping up a jacket to tying shoes to working cooperatively with peers. And then another thing that we really need to be doing with kids that age is teaching them to ask questions and be comfortable interacting with adults and seeking help when they have questions. And this is something that there's a lot of good research on how teachers and parents can interact with children to encourage that sort of curiosity.
I was interested to see economist James Heckman's research on this. He's from the University of Chicago, and he's sort of looked at what happens to kids when they're in pre-K, that they actually not only do better in school, they end up costing society less. They're less likely to end up on welfare, less likely to end up in jail. What's the thinking in terms of when you're looking at cost-benefit of how much these programs would cost and then how much we save ultimately?
I don't think you can say really specifically with numbers, but definitely the two sort of best studies of pre-K are the Abecedarian Project from North Carolina and the Perry Preschool Project in Michigan. And those clearly show that there's reduced incarceration rates, reduced homelessness, and reduced unemployment for people who had high-quality pre-K early in life. So that's a very clear argument that the investment, although it would be billions of dollars, the investment early in life can lead to dividends later on.
And we heard from President Obama earlier about how he was trying to restructure Head Start to make it work better. And you mentioned Governor Mitt Romney, when he was governor in Massachusetts, vetoed a mandatory kindergarten law that's now become law since he's not been governor anymore. He mentioned early childhood education once during his speech at the Republican convention. Let's take a listen to this.
We helped start an early childhood learning company called Bright Horizons that First Lady Michelle Obama rightly praised.
And by we, he's talking about Bain there. So what do we know about Governor Romney and early childhood education?
Well, Bright Horizons was one company that Bain Capital did invest in. And what they do is they provide on-site childcare and early education for Fortune 500 companies like Target and Johnson & Johnson. And it's a for-profit provider. And they are considered a very excellent provider. I just think it's interesting that he highlighted it. It definitely focuses on the for-profit educational sector, which is much smaller than the nonprofit or the government-run sector. And it kind of shows what his thinking is and what his orientation is toward education generally.
How do other countries handle pre-K education? You mentioned Finland and France in your article in Good Magazine. How has it worked there?
Yeah, I mean, this is one reason why I really wanted to write that piece. I mean, here in the United States, the social contract really begins when children are 5 or 6 and they enter K-12 education. In those other nations, the social contract is really from birth. I mean, in Finland, when your baby's 3 months old, you can drop them off 24 hours a day at an early childhood care and education center. 1/3 of all the staff in that center have to have a college degree. This is just really vastly different than what we see here in the United States. The typical child care worker here might earn less than $10 an hour. Only 25% of 3- to 5-year-olds are enrolled in a center with a certified teacher working in it. So the workforce in early childhood education also has to really improve. So we need to invest in that workforce, and then we need to expand opportunities for families to enroll their kids in this, because only 12% of this population is eligible for Head Start, the 12% poorest. But as a lot of middle-class parents here in New York know, it is expensive. Private preschool is expensive, and your kid may not be eligible for those public options. So we need to do something for the vast middle.
How much is the conversation when you talk about pre-K education? You mentioned there early childhood education and child care. How much of this is about child care and freeing up mothers and fathers to, you know, get work that they might otherwise not be able to if they're caring for their kid at home?
Yeah, that's a really important point. As the world is today, the vast majority of mothers of young children are working already. And so we see a lot of mothers are leaving kids with family members or friends. They're sort of informal arrangements. And school is an improvement over that, because you're going to have more trained educators working with kids to really move them toward being ready for kindergarten. And mothers are working. This is not something that's negotiable in most families financially.
Hmm. So how are we talking? And give me sort of how much are people talking about universal pre-K as far as an actual policy proposal? I mean, kindergarten, as I said, is not mandatory yet. Is this even something that people are talking about when they're looking at shrinking revenues and trying to figure out how to budget scarce resources?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not really realistic politically. I mean, even Obama's race to the top early childhood competition, which was one part of Race to the Top, really didn't vastly increase access to pre-K. It was more focused on quality, making sure the quality is good, making sure that states are collecting data. It's very expensive. I mean, that's the reality of it. Some states, like Massachusetts, like New Jersey, have chosen to make it a priority. Most haven't. In Arizona in 2011, they actually canceled their state funding for pre-K, so that was a backward step. So unfortunately, it hasn't really been much on the agenda. At the Democratic Convention, you heard a lot of sort of head nods toward how important early childhood education is, but without a lot of details, in part because when you have someone like Paul Ryan putting out a budget that cuts all domestic spending by 50%, it's really hard to imagine how we can embrace a priority like this nationally.
All right, Dana Goldstein, she is with the Nation Institute and the New America Foundation. She's written about a big idea of universal pre-K education, something to talk about during this election season. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you.
Coming up, we've got Bob Kolker from New York Magazine to talk about cheating in schools. Why do students do it? We'll talk about that after the break.